top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die, only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
That's the ghost of Colin Childress.
30 years ago, he butchered a woman with an axe and then set himself on fire.
It's dark, it's gloomy, it's filled with terror.
Don't even think about going down there.
So why can't people stay out of the cellar?
I love to be frightened.
If you love to be frightened, then this cellar is the place to be.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 256 for horror title rhyming completists everywhere, Cellar Dweller. So following on the heels of Fright Night, Jack's Back, The Driller Killer. This is a rhyming title monster movie, which is super fun, a creature feature with all the elements of a 50s horror, but filmed in 1988.
Well, all the elements, but yet at the very same time, this film is definitely a product of its times. I mean, it totally felt like a late 80s straight-to-video horror film, which is what it was, and that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. That's one of the things that, you know, children of the 80s are so nostalgic about, is going to those old mom-and-pop shops and browsing the aisles in the horror section and just looking at it's sensory overload, you know? And sometimes, I mean, I was alive and well in 88. I don't recall it. Because sometimes, you know, the more lurid covers, which is, it was just grab your attention so much, like, you know, your Nightmare on Elm Street with Freddy's Burned Visage, or something like Blood Feast, where they would really, like, take the most disgusting, even if it was, like, you know, so obviously, like, red paint or whatever, it would look so garish on those video boxes, that sometimes you wouldn't notice something a little bit more benign? Is that?
No, fair enough, yeah.
Like Cellar Dweller, and frankly, I was not really aware of this film. It really wasn't on my radar until we decided that we were going to discuss it for the podcast. I am a Jeffrey Combs fan. However, I'm not a Jeffrey Combs completist by any stretch of the imagination. He's in it. We're going to talk about Jeffrey Combs in a moment or two, I'm sure, because you really like him. So let's go. Let's just start by having Jeffrey Combs first and foremost.
Well, I guess at the time he would have been a hot commodity, hot on the heels of our mutual favorites, From Beyond and Reanimator, which
he would have been a hot commodity, but that would have been in the hot commodity of the horror world, that circle.
Yeah, I mean? Well, I mean, I don't think this would have had, I'm guessing, broader appeal than the circles in which we travel.
He wasn't in line to replace Roger Moore as the next James Bond.
No, that's true. But he just has an incredible competence and earnestness and determination that sets him apart. He's the quintessential geek in horror. He's just perfect as the mad scientist updated for the modern day. He just envelops that role so, like, the Dr. West, he's done a bunch of Lovecraft adaptations, but these are the ones that are just...
With Stuart Gordon, a lot of them are associated with each other, and Gordon is known for a plethora of Lovecraft adaptations.
And there's a blink and you miss it poster of Reanimator on the wall in the house here. So again, there's little nods to him. They probably ascertained or surmised that maybe this would give it a little more of a draw. But really, I could not get any figures for how well this did. I believe it was re-released by Scream sometime 4 or 5 years ago. But you know, it made a ripple. No, so
because the thing about Jeffrey Combs, I have nothing negative to say about him. I appreciate him. I like every time I see Jeffrey Combs in the credits of a movie, I'm happy that he's in there and I get to see him. However, I'll never forget, it was really early in the podcast. Maybe we were discussing, maybe it was our god-awful second or third episode, which was From Beyond.
Yeah. Wow, like all the awful vocal affectations. Oh, and it clocked in at a whopping I mean, there are lovemaking sessions that go on longer than that podcast.
For some reason, I thought that the fact that Ken Ford wore a Speedo was the height of hilarity. So
yeah. We like to think in the interceding 200-plus episodes, we've been able to more finely hone our craft and come into our own as broadcasters.
That was rough.
That was a tough one, and I've re-listened to...
And not for a lack of not having enough to discuss. From Beyond is an incredible movie. We could... talk,
yeah,
but we just didn't.
We didn't know what we were doing. It sort of belied the fact that there's one of the great horror films of all time, Reanimator, being in my top 10, if not my top 5, and we were unable to squeeze any nectar out of this rotten fruit out of 12 minutes, 12 bloody minutes.
And I even sent that episode to Barbara Crampton, hoping that she would love it and like.
Oh,
scream from the mountains, yeah. How great we are. This would take us to the next drive here.
That was a rather humbling affair. But yeah. everyone's first time didn't go well, right? But let's put it that way. And that was not okay. Even though it was our third, it was our third time. It was not good. And Your Hunter from the Future, another one that clocked in at a whopping 11 minutes,
yeah.
Where we found Reb Brown's Joan Rivers wig, the peak of comedic hilarity. So
what I found was that all the cavemen look like George Harrison, Seagal Things Must Pass. So,
which is actually, this is very true, but yeah.
But one thing I remember you saying, and this is like, I took such umbrage to this, and this is why like Jeffrey Combs, is I like him, but I'm not like over the moon, is you said that he's a modern day Vincent Price, and I was like, there is no comparison to Vincent Price.
No, I guess in some of the iconic roles that he inhabited during the Poe films and the Corman films, I would say that there's no replacing Vincent Price. Although, I guess they might match up in terms of work rate, because Jeffrey Combs is consistently working. He is in every show. He's got 100 plus credits. He will work until he's dead. And so in that respect, they have it. There's no replacing the irreplaceable, but...
I stopped watching the show in the third season. I think it's ending, thankfully, this season, Gotham. And I saw Jeffrey Combs in an episode of that, and... First, it was a little hard to recognize him.
His hairline is pulling a LeBron James. It's just retreating to the back of his head. And he is in one of the Star Trek spinoffs as well. If it's not Babylon, one of the ones I don't watch. I only really watched a couple of those. So, yeah.
Babylon 5 was something else completely.
He's on one of these shows. Yeah. Like, again, his credits run the gamut. You know. So
Scott Bakula was a captain for one of these. So I love Scott Bakula.
So do I. I've been told I somewhat resemble him. Which is, you could see it a little, right?
First you told me it's Joaquin Phoenix. I understand Scott Bakula. Like,
I'm a cross between...
Two more disparate-looking people, really. And, okay, they're both Caucasian, but what else do they have in common? You know what I mean?
I think I oscillate between the two. If I gain a little bit of weight, then I'll more be on the Scott Bakula side. But yeah, I think definitely the... Gladiator. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the Joaquin Phoenix I sort of resemble at my best.
Are you not entertained, Chris?
I am entertained. I'm giving the thumbs up, you know. But Jeffrey Combs here, a bit part.
A bit part, that's why. Yeah, he's really only in it for the prologue.
And this is really a bit movie. He plays a cartoonist who meets his demise in a... how would you describe it? Like, he meets
a grizzly.
A grizzly, yeah. Mysterious circumstances, let's put it that way.
The people that were trying to figure out what happened to this noted cartoonist, comic book artist, but not mysterious as the audience, we see what happens. He's drawing a comic book. He's drawing a comic book about a certain vengeful monster. He needs a little bit of inspiration. He picks up a tome of
books. Oh, yes.
Every time you see a book, mm-hmm. you know something bad's going to happen, right? Now, this book was basically the Necronomicon from Evil Dead, if made by a third-grade craft project.
Yeah.
It had the same sort of incantation and so on, but the thing looked like it was held together by twine. But anyway,
doesn't matter.
In doing so, he wanted dialogue to put into his monster's, that he was drawing, mouth, and he uttered an incantation. And what ended up happening is that what he drew came to fruition, the monster was born, the particular cellar dweller. All of a sudden, there's a woman that off the page being attacked by the monster. Now she's actually there. She's being attacked by the very same monster. Of course, Combs was the one who was accused. The cartoonist goes mad, etc. Murder, suicide. Boom. Flash forward. Combs is done. Gone. His presence looms over the rest of the movie, but he's no longer in the movie.
But when you think about it, that's a pretty amazing trope. When you think about it as someone who's in the arts, someone who has their creation literally come to life. That's the metaphor people use when a character comes to life. So he draws it and it springs to life. So I find that's wonderful.
Seems like Simon.
My name is. Well, I was going to say it's more a trope among children's films where you write something or draw something and it comes to life in a part live action, part cartoon type movies. It's not as much the case in horror, but it works to tremendous effect. So 30 years later, you have Colin Childress, who's the artist whose influence is continued to be expressed in some of his proteges, and one of whom is this art student played by Deborah, I want to say her last name's Fantino, but it's not, Whitney. Whitney Taylor, and she is has idolized this cartoonist whose work is very much like Tales from the Crypt,
For sure. I mean, that's one thing I totally dug about this film. There was a very much an EC Comics aesthetic, even during the opening credits.
Oh, yeah. Various panels that stuff. Font is like, boom.
Kind of reminded me a bit of Wes Craven's Swamp Thing with the credits and so on. And yeah, EC, I mean, yeah. I grew up on EC, so I'm an EC kid. So that really hit home to me.
Yeah, and she's almost trying to follow in his footsteps. So she signs up for this art school in the middle of the woods. So it's funny you mentioned the Necronomicon, because this almost has a Cabin in the Woods, Evil Dead feel, house.
There was one shot that was totally crib right from the Evil Dead, where the camera was the POV of like the evil entity entering the house.
Yeah, and even the structure of the house. Like, there's many similarities, I guess, to Evil Dead, also with the basement too. But this is not what strikes me as what I would think of when I think of an art school.
Well, okay, here's the thing. First of all, it's not an art school, it's a colony. As Mrs. Briggs, you know, played by Yvonne DiCarlo.
It may well be a colony, but you still have to have there's an entrance exam, and you have to submit your resume and your marks. So it's a retreat, and more than it is an institute. A la Juilliard or some art school. It's a retreat.
So what I found kind of interesting is when Whitney arrives to the colony, I got a real Suspiria vibe for a moment or two. I mean, not that this is anywhere near. It's kind of, I'm saying, you know, it's very funny because that Suspiria remake just came and went, right? It was barely a blip. So I don't even have to qualify by saying Suspiria 77 or whatever.
Yeah. You know?
The Suspiria remake really made not much of an impression on audiences at all.
Certainly not on us, although we committed and promised ourselves a second viewing. We've got to leave enough passage of time to see if we can...
But here you have a girl dropped off by a cab in an unfamiliar area in the middle of nowhere, trying to get into this school. She's now, you know, going to be enrolling in this school. It's the middle of the night. She's wandering around. What the heck is going on?
The school is run by this odd matriarch. Yeah. Good call. Yeah.
Yeah. So, that was it. It ended right there. The first comparison to Suspiria. Yeah. Basically, what this movie was you had an overgrown critter running around. That was the cellar dweller. He was a massive, giant, hairy beast. He was across from, let's say, Rawhead Rex and the critters, the creeds, whatever, from the critter movies, with a giant pentagram on his chest. He was kind of cute. I thought he was kind of...
Well, I'm going to say, speaking of beasts, he was a little bit, a little bit of a critters, a little bit of beast from X-Men. There you go.
Except he wasn't blue.
No, but he had that kind of, the gorilla strength. He had the brawn. He had that musculature. And that character was great. I mean, the drawings, as were introduced to that cellar dweller, the titular cellar dweller, he's fantastic. He leaps off the page. And as Whitney is reproducing some of Childress's work, I mean, you can tell, like, it's kind of, they didn't exactly play that hand too well. The fact that whoever female hand was drawing that, they gave her like the most basic little dots to draw that creature. I was like, man, this is bad.
Well,
like,
this first of all, this is okay. So this is an art school / colony. People are working on various different mediums with their art. You have filmmakers, you have performance artists, you have
new media, you have method actors. No,
there was one commonality. Everybody was terrible.
Yeah.
Everybody was so fucking amateurish. Did you see those paintings? believe it was Brian Robbins' character. What's Philip? Was he the one?
Yeah, Philip. I believe his surname is Lemley, and he's got this ridiculous sort of fey scarf. His work is kind of, I mean, they were trumpeting it as the latest in like kind of an example of Manet expressionism. But meanwhile, it was just really mediocre primitivism. I mean, he would just draw a cow in one scene and said it represented angst. And they were looking at it and going like, I don't get it. Like, it's just.
All I know is I'm a terrible artist. And I drew better than him in grade one. I did better than him in grade one. Okay, end of story.
Yeah. Well, his work is not, and they make light of his work too, as they do to Whitney's work, because they are dismissive of it because her arch nemesis and fellow art school grad is named Amanda, and she works in new media, nascent video technology. So she's always walking around with a video camera trying to make these video installation type things. And they look down upon Whitney's work as stuff for kids. Like, didn't that stuff fall out of favor? Or isn't it like why are you still working in that medium?
It was Mrs. Briggs, the matriarch. And just before we continue on, Yvonne DiCarlo, who played Mrs. Briggs, what's she most famous for?
Well, Sephora, the wife of Moses, let my people go in Ten Commandments.
That
was her most
notable film role. Mm-hmm. What about the small screen? Lily Munster.
Oh, yes.
She was Lily Munster herself. She was next to Fred Gwynn as Herman.
On a much, much, you know, from the sublime to the ridiculous. I believe... was it head of the class that the other...
Well, that's what I want to talk
about. Okay, yeah.
So we're
so many important principles
indeed,
in this film.
Indeed. Okay, so I'm sort of saving it for what did I learn. Hmm. Yes, Brian Robbins was on the show Head of the Class, which I absolutely adored. Okay? It was a show that was on the air at the time that this thing came out in 88. It's a funny show because I watched every episode. I don't remember one episode. I don't remember one situation, one character, and yet I really liked the show. It was some sort of like updated Welcome Back, Cotter.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, I hope I'm not wrong, because it's 80s, like you watch these in reruns, but Billy Connolly, the Scottish comedian, was in for like a
cup of coffee.
Yeah.
Howard Hessman was the teacher. Howard Hessman from, of course, W.K. or P.S.
This is Spinal Tap. Yeah. Like,
he was the teacher. He had this motley crew of kids from all around the he had this motley crew of students that he had to, you know, teach and whatever, and they all had their own little idiosyncrasies and so on. Brian Robbins' character was more of the kind of the tough, like, you know, sweat hog type character, really. And after about maybe five, this was a long running show, I think around from like 86 to 91, and then Hessman left the show, so they just, okay, your new teacher is all the way from Scotland, and it was Billy Connolly. That was my introduction to Billy Connolly. I loved the Connolly seasons. They were funnier as far as I was concerned, because he's funnier.
That's true. It's just, oh my God, I just can't imagine him as a street tough, like a leather jacket clad guy. Like, my memories of the show are practically non-existent, but I could not have, I mean, he's short too.
Well, but there's one thing I'm going to say for what did I learn about Brian Robbins' involvement, but... So yeah, Brian Robbins from Head of the Class, and I'm going to talk a bit more about him later on. Another person I want to talk about is the director of this film, John Carl Buechler. He's mostly known as an effects man, Roger Corman. Yet again, we talked about Roger Corman last week. He did a lot of makeup for New World Pictures, which was one of Corman's production houses, and called Buechler the best in the business. Now, in addition to this movie, I think Buechler's two most notable credits are Friday the 13th Part 7, he directed
New
that
Blood.
New Blood, yeah. Indeed. And the original Troll. When I say the original Troll, the movie that begat Troll 2.
And begat the documentary about Troll 2.
Exactly. But the original Troll had absolutely nothing to do with Troll 2. It was actually about trolls. Hilariously enough, Michael Moriarty was in it. They had a character in the original Troll that was named Harry Potter in the early 80s.
Wow.
Yeah. And there's, I know, kind of blows your mind, right?
Yeah, my mind is blown.
But yeah, so Buechler directed this one. Yeah, I mean, his most notable credit would be Friday 13th Part 7, but I mean, he's he's been in and around and all over the place, and yeah.
Well, I gotta say, this cabin is not dissimilar from the cabins that the counselors would have inhabited in Crystal Lake as well. So the cabin is definitely
it's not dissimilar from the cabins in Heavyweights.
Oh my God! Well, maybe it's the same cabin, but definitely that Evil Dead, Friday the 13th kind of motif, which is funny when you mention that the creature from Evil Dead is like you see the POV like hurtling into the. Into this cabin in the woods,
yeah, but the camera represents evil force.
The evil force, but once they get inside, this is a very internal, small interior of a movie. Mm-hmm. And usually, in the types of movies where you see where the specter of evil presence lurks, you cross a threshold, and you have people who are wondering whether they should inhabit said space. This, everyone is fine with the space they're in, and there's no sense of foreboding, really, other than Mrs. Briggs, the matriarch, and this headmistress, if you will, saying, don't go in the basement.
Because they all know the history of the house.
They all do, and they are given this caveat not to go in the basement, which is kind of weird in a way. So it's not this house that people think is going to be good that turns bad, or that you think will be bad. It really is just a house. It's Thornton, whatever, I forget the school. It's just, it looks pretty harmless.
Throw in another Italian horror reference, The House by the Cemetery. Something evil lurking in the basement, the cellar dweller.
I guess, although that had the dreamscape of the and you knew something was amiss because there was a nightmarish hellscape as you led your way into the house. But this one seemed as innocuous as a so-called haunted house could possibly be. Mm-hmm. And even when they went into the basement, there were not many frights to derive therein. It was just you walk down to the basement, shine a light, see the weird science Tales from the Crypt font of the workspace that Colin Childress inhabited. You see his the stuff he was working on. You see the chest containing the stuff he was working on. There's no frights to be derived from going into the basement. There was not like this threshold to cross, do not go in the basement. What happens if you do? Nothing really happens when they do, although the creature does get unleashed, but there's no frights to be had by breaching that boundary. So that was kind of unique. They actually get along quite well in the house.
Well,
all these different characters,
Amanda and Whitney,
yeah, because they were at but I found that dynamic very funny. So you have this guy who's influenced by like Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler.
It was so ridiculous.
So he's got these suspenders and he's trying to act out this hard-boiled detective novellas from the 50s and 60s. And he has a gun and he enlists the help of other actors to method act scenes. And the others don't know they're method acting. So that's a sense of surprise when he actually starts shooting this pistol off in the middle of the house. Like, it's very campy and very absurd. You have the Amanda characters working in the new medium of video, and she's filming everything there is and like sticking her camera where it doesn't belong.
She's enlisting Mrs. Briggs to circuitously spy on the camera and see if
it's pretty bizarre.
They work together to get out of the school because they both resented her. And
there's a character who's doing almost like a Primal Scream exercises. Salt. Yeah, she's workshopping.
Therapy.
Yeah, she's workshopping like a character in the woods. Yeah, I think it's something completely different.
Oh, okay, whatever.
Yeah, they're both lunatic therapies that have been discredited. Well, not shock therapy actually surprisingly still has its uses, although it's been fine-tuned so it doesn't shock every part of your cranium.
I don't say shock therapy, it's like gestalt.
Oh, gestalt therapy.
Yeah.
My God, I don't know enough about that. But, well, she's doing some sort of Primal Scream workshopping of some character in the woods, and she's screaming by the window, and she's guzzling a bottle of wine. So you have the disparate kind of art school type characters you would expect to inhabit such a retreat/colony.
Yeah, but nobody really seem like an authentic artiste, you know what I mean?
That's
like,
true. That was not very well developed. But I think that given the space they had to work in,
not Confidential or anything like that, that's for sure. But anyway.
Well, they didn't have much in the way of characters because they had very small space to work within. I think the entire budget was spent on the practical creature effects and to the expense of everything else, which is as small.
As it should be, man. Like, I'm telling you, if you have a low budget, low amount of money to work with when you're making a monster movie, put that money into the monster because that is the selling point, right? So, you got a good monster and a lot of other stuff can be forgiven. Shoddy set design, shoddy acting, script inconsistencies, etc. Put a good monster in there, good kills, maybe a little bit of period of nudity here.
I guess so, which this one had in spades. It just this one is too, almost, I would say, too self-contained, because there are movies that have take place in I'd say more sprawling abodes and dwelling places. And I'm thinking like the burnt offerings or the changeling, something where you feel like you're transplanted to a space, even if it's one space. Here I was not invested in this space particularly. I wasn't finding it particularly evocative or interesting in a way that I did those other two homes, where they took on a character unto themselves. So this, they're essentially banking on the fact that whoever goes in the basement is going to be the victim. Or
but there's more to than that. I mean, because Whitney resurrects the monster, now she has the power that whatever she draws comes to life, and then all of a sudden she's not even drawing anymore, right? Things are being drawn in the passive voice, and her mates in the whatever colony or school are getting killed in some very kind of cool, gruesome ways. I mean, one guy gets his head just swatted clean off. I love that death.
That was pretty great. And as her nemesis is getting preyed upon by the creature, she is writing like a speech bubble on the page saying, "Somebody help me." And then there's a corresponding "help me, Fay Wray type beast," set upon the damsel kind of in distress scene there too. So that was kind of neat. So, they're sort of blending the two worlds together.
So in this movie, I mean, honestly, dude, like the sense of place meant very little to me because of the fact that I knew this was very low budget. So when it came to location, they didn't have a lot to work with. For me, it was all about the monster, all about the titular Cellar Dweller, and that delivered in spades, so I was happy with that. So, at this point, would you want to segue into what did we learn? Okay, I'll start. I have a younger sister, she's 2 years younger than me, and she was an avid purchaser of teen magazines. Teen Beat, Bop, 16, I can go Tiger Beat, I can go on and on and on. And because they'd be writing about, oh, Kirk Cameron is so dreamy, or Michael J. Fogg, but I would read these magazines because there was some sort of crossover, because I didn't care about the dreaminess of Kirk Cameron, but I liked Growing Pains. I liked Family Ties, you know? Alyssa Milano was always featured, and I had a massive crush on her, mm-hmm. age-appropriate, of course. So I would read my sister's teen magazines, and Brian Robbins was a teen heartthrob, a teen idol. They would feature him in these magazines, right? Now, even back then, there's a hierarchy, a case system, a class of idols. You had, like, you know, your Camerons, your Foxes, your, I don't know, who were the other major ones of the 80s, right? And then you had Rob Lowe's, the whole Brat Pack, and then you had, like, your lesser-known ones, your Scott Grimes, your Chad Allens, your Brian Robbins, right? But they would be, you know, a lot of them were on TV. For example, Chad Allen was on a show, I think it was called Our House, I don't recall. But they would be on the cover, you know, they wouldn't be the big picture, maybe the small in the corner, and they'd have a little interview, a little blurb. And the other thing these movies did, the other thing these magazines did, like Bop or whatever, is if Brian Robbins or Scott Grimes or Mackenzie Austin or whatever was appearing in an upcoming movie, they would promote the movie, right? And it didn't matter what sort of movie it was. Just by virtue of these teen idols were in these movies, they would, these magazines. So this is a movie that would have been promoted in the pages of Tiger Beat, Teen Beat, what have you. Despite the fact that, yes, this movie does have boobs, it has blood, it's not, it did feel a little more kid-friendly than a lot of other, you know, horror movies of the time. But they still had to put in the blood, the gore, and the boobs in order to really, you know, maximize the profits. So I just find it hilarious that a girl at the age of 14 that might have had, like, the biggest crush on Brian Robbins, and she reads about this, oh my God, Cellar Dweller, I gotta see this movie, begs her parents to rent it for her, and then she puts it on, and probably watching with her parents, and they're just aghast. How did you hear about this movie? I read about it in Bop!
Oh my God.
There goes your Bop subscription. Chris, what did you learn?
Oh my God. Well, yeah, as you said, like, the artistic forms and media are not exactly very well represented here. The nemesis of Whitney is Amanda, and she apparently had been dabbling in all sorts of different, she was like a Renaissance woman. She started off in whatever, she was a queen of sculptress, then she became an actress, then she went into new media, and her work couldn't be any more underwhelming, like really bad. And then there's a scene where they have an elaborate, like, protracted smashing of all this sculpture work, and that was just really like stuff you'd see on like the front lawn of some cheesy Italian house, you know what I mean, like some awful like crude Venus de Milo you'd get at maybe a gardening center store. Like it was like really crappy mise-en-scène here, like some crappy art, like they didn't even try.
Blame the Simpsons now for taking the
the Botticelli Venus and ruining it forever.
According to some art, now every time somebody mentions it,
the gummy de Milo,
I'm like reducing my head to a piece of candy. That Homer
Stop Simpson. Saying gummy.
Gummy. A sweet, sweet can. one of the classic episodes.
Well, if this place was, because at one point, I guess Mrs. Briggs said, oh, we don't do any of that trite populist art here. And I was like, okay, it seemed pretty trite to me. Like these.
No, we just do amateur work here. <Yeah. you know? laughs> Popular is accomplished. Okay.
Chock-a-block, crappy, like arms missing sculpture that you just pull out of a you know prop shop anywhere. It's just not really bad.
Member of this again colony had an iota of artistic
abilities. Not one. And then when you compare it to Suspiria, especially the 2018 version, where that was a top tier dance studio. And you could guess that the creme de la creme of dancers from all over Europe were going there. Here, there's like finger painting in like fourth grade or whatever.
At one point, Brian Robbins says that. He says to Whitney, he's like, okay, nice talking to you. I got to go finger paint. That was the line in the movie.
Did they know it?
Of course they did.
But if their work was so awful, the same could not be said.
I'm not talking about the actual characters. I'm talking about the filmmakers knew that this artwork was awful.
Well, but Whitney's artwork was splendid. It was absolutely fantastic. It was well done.
Cartooning. I mean, it
very wasn't. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know enough about the genre, but I thought it was like, she had a pretty deft hand.
Jim Starlin or anything like that. I mean, it was just basic.
It was not Robert Crumb or Ralph Steadman or anything.
You're wrong. I saw that look on your face, and I think I kind of interrupted you when you brought up the Beast.
Yeah.
We were so happy that we became comic book.
Finally, yeah. It was the only comic book I read as a kid growing up. So I was ecstatic to see that creature, rendered here on screen.
You look at your kid in the cancer box, yeah. And I said, oh, but he's not blue, and I took away your bleeding.
Oh, my God. It took the wind right out of my comic sails. Well, I mean, turns out we learned quite a bit, actually, here. Star rating?
This movie, sometimes I feel like this is a cop-out star rating, but it's 3 stars. You know, just right down the middle of the road. It's not going to change your life. That's for sure. It's not going to rock to the top of your, you know, all-time, like, greatest horror films ever made. But you will be entertained if you keep your expectations at a minimum. So, yeah, 3 stars. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I was trying for the life of me to come up with some exemplars of art come to life films, and I couldn't think of any really like stuff from the page popping into realistic form in a way space.
There's a local filmmaker by the name of Chris Treblecock who made a film called The Dark Stranger, which dealt with just that. It played mostly festivals. It played here in the Blood and the Snow Festival.
Mm-hmm.
I reviewed it for the site.
Okay,
I got a screener of it. But a very different tone than this one. This was in many ways kind of campy and hokey.
Because I want to say, like, particularly in Hammer, there would have been eyes following you from an oil painting, mm-hmm. let's say. I think that's a fairly common where art comes alive, leitmotif or whatever in these films. But I couldn't. I was trying to find, like, what is this movie like?
And then, of course, you know, I mean, there's other movies like The Stendhal Syndrome where our heroine almost goes into the
paintings. Yes, but that's true. Yeah.
As far as art coming to life, I mean,
there's art in the broader sense coming to life where you have a novelist whose characters start to haunt him. That's different, but not in the medium of painting or drawing. So yeah, novelist, fine. You can a half dozen you could rattle off that we've mentioned in other podcasts, but yeah. not apart from Stendhal, not art coming to life in this kind of capacity. Well, so that was kind of interesting.
I mean, I guess that stuff is reserved for Night at the Museum, right?
Oh, God, yeah. So. I watched that on a plane. It was just, oof, that was rough going. Ben Stiller, man, heavyweights, that was wonderful, you know, but that one, not so much. Yeah, I mean, I don't see it as a cop-out as much as it allows us to... It gives us more wiggle room because it's worth seeing, but you don't necessarily have to see it. So 3 is right down the middle out of 5.
It allows us to give the film some credit, mm-hmm. you know, to give it a positive review, but to be, you know, to not be over the moon ecstatic. So you're right, it's not quite a cop-out.
Yeah.
So 3 stars for me.
And be sure to check in every Friday to listen to our 5-star podcast, the Really Awful Movies podcast.
Yeah, cop-out, the movie was... No, that was Copland.
Okay.
Wait, what's that movie? Cop out?
I feel like there should be if there wasn't.
God awful movie with Bruce Willis and somebody.
It sounds like.
Yeah,
I think every pun you could play on cop has been utilized in some fashion. If you like what you're listening to, leave us a review on iTunes. It's really helpful for having folks.
Or, as I said before, anywhere you could leave a review.
Yeah, Stitcher, wherever. You name it.
Podcatcher app you use.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic. It would help people find the show. And we'll talk to you soon.
Take care. Thank you.